A racing car tore toward me and stopped with a squeal of tires on the road. A man jumped out. "Your car, Honorable Lobsang Rampa. Shall I turn it first?" "No," I replied. "Go down the hill toward the left." I jumped in beside the driver. The monk who had been summoned by the abbot had rushed off to Chongqing to obtain a driver and powerful car. This was indeed a powerful vehicle, an immense black American monster. I sat beside the driver and we sped through the night on the road to Chengdu, 200 miles from Chongqing. Ahead of us great pools of light raced from headlamps, showing up the unevenness of the road, illuminating the trees by the side, and making grotesque shadows as if daring us to catch them, as if urging us on faster and faster. The driver, Ejn, was a good driver, well-trained, capable and safe. Faster and faster we went with the road a mere blur. I sat back, and thought. I had in my mind the thought of my beloved guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, and the way he had trained me, all that he had done for me. He had been more to me than my own parents. I had in my mind also the thought of my beloved ruler, the L3TH Dalai Lama, the last of his line, for the old prophecy said that the L3TH Dalai Lama would pass and with his passing would come a new order to Tibet. In 1950 the Chinese communists began their invasion of Tibet, but before this the communist third column had been in Lhasa. I thought of all this which I knew was going to happen. I knew this in 1933. I knew it before 1933 because it all followed exactly according to the prophecy. So we raced on through the night 200 miles to Chengdu. At Chengdu we got more petrol, we stretched our legs for 10 minutes, and had food. Then on we went again, the wild drive through the night, through the darkness from Chengdu to Yan, 100 miles further on, and there, as dawn was breaking, as the first streaks of light were shining in the sky, the road ended, the car could go no further. I went to a lamasery where by telepathy, the message had been received that I was on my way. A horse was ready, a high-spirited horse, one that kicked and reared, but in this emergency I had no time to pander to a horse. I got on, and stayed on, and the horse did my bidding as if it knew of the urgency of our mission. The groom released the bridle and off we shot, up the road, onwards on the way to Tibet. The car would return to Chongqing, the driver having the pleasure of a soft speedy ride, while I had to sit in the high wooden saddle and ride on and on, changing horses after the end of a good run, changing always to high-spirited animals which had plenty of power because I was in a hurry. There is no need to tell of the trials of that journey, the bitter hardships of one solitary horseman. No need to tell of the crossing of the Yangtze River, and onto the upper Sail Wein. I raced on and on. It was grueling work riding like this, but I made it in time. I turned through a pass in the mountains, and once again gazed upon the golden roofs of the Potala. I gazed upon the domes which hid the earthly remains of other bodies of the Dalai Lama, and I thought how soon would there be another dome concealing another body. I rode on, and crossed again the Happy River. It was not happy for me this time. I crossed it and went along and I was in time. The hard, rushed journey had not been in vain. I was there for all the ceremonials and I took a very active part in them. There was, for me, a further unpleasant incident. A foreigner was there who wanted all consideration for himself. He thought that we were just natives, and that he was lord of all he surveyed. He wanted to be in the front of everything, noticed by all. And because I would not further his selfish aim, he tried to bribe a friend and me with wristwatches! He has regarded me as an enemy ever since, and has indeed gone out of his way, has gone to extreme lengths, to injure me and mine. However, that has nothing to do with it, except that it shows how right were my tutors when they warned me of jealousy. They were very sad days indeed for us. And I do not propose to write about the ceremonial nor about the disposal of the Dalai Lama. It will suffice to say that his body was preserved according to our ancient method, and placed in a sitting position, facing the south as demanded by tradition. Time after time the head would turn toward the east. Many consider this to be a pointer from beyond death, saying that we must look toward the east. Well, The Chinese invaders came from the east to disrupt Tibet. That turning to the east was indeed a sign, a warning. If only we could have heeded it. I went again to the home of my parents. Old Tsu had died. Many of the people that I had known were changed. All was strange there. It was not a home to me. I was just a caller, a stranger, a high lama, a high dignitary of the temple who had returned temporarily from China. I was kept waiting to see my parents. At last I was conducted to them. Talk was forced, the atmosphere was strained. I was no longer a son of the house, but a stranger. But not quite a stranger in the sense that is usually meant, for my father conducted me to his private room. And there he took from its safe stronghold our record, and carefully unwrapped it from its golden covering. Without a word I signed my name, the last entry. I signed my name, my rank, and my new qualifications as a qualified doctor and surgeon. Then the book was solemnly rewrapped and replaced in its hiding place beneath the floor. Together we returned to the room in which my mother and my sister sat. I made my farewells and turned away. In the courtyard the grooms were holding my horse. I mounted and passed through the great gates for the last time. It was with a heavy heart that I turned into the Linka Road and made my way to Menzikang, which is the main Tibetan hospital. I had worked here and now I was paying a courtesy call to the huge old monk who was in charge, Shinro Bonobo. I knew him well, a nice old man. He had taught me a lot after I had left Iron Hill Medical School. He took me into his room and asked me about Chinese medicine. I said, "They claim in China that they were the first to use acupuncture and moxibustion, but I know better. I have seen in the old records how these two remedies were brought from Tibet to be used in China years and years ago." He was most interested when I told him that the Chinese, and Western powers too, were investigating why these two remedies worked, because work they assuredly did. Acupuncture is a special method of inserting extremely fine needles into various parts of the body. They are so fine that no pain is felt. These needles are inserted and they stimulate various healing reactions. They use radium needles, and claim wonderful cures for it, but we of the East have used acupuncture for centuries, with equal success. We have also used moxibustion. This is a method of preparing various herbs in a tube and igniting one end so that it glows red. This glowing end is brought near to a diseased skin and tissue, and in heating that area the virtue of the herbs passes direct to the tissues with curative effect. These two methods have been proved again and again, but how precisely they work has not been determined. I looked again into the great storehouse in which were kept the many, many herbs, more than 6,000 different types. Most of them unknown to China, unknown to the rest of the world. Tatura, for instance, which is the root of a tree, was a most powerful anesthetic, and it could keep a person completely anesthetized for 12 hours at a stretch, and, in the hands of a good practitioner, there would be no undesirable after effects whatever. I looked around, and I could find nothing with which to find fault in spite of all the modern advances of China and America. The old Tibetan cures still were satisfactory. That night I slept in my old place, and as in the days when I was a pupil I attended the services. It all carried me back. What memories there were in every one of those stones. In the morning when it was light I climbed to the highest part of Iron Mountain, and gazed out over the Potala, over the Serpent Park, over Lhasa, and into the snow-clad mountains surrounding. I gazed long and then I went back into the medical school and said my farewells and took my bag of tsampa. Then with my blanket rolled and my spare robe in front of me I remounted my horse and made my way down the hill. The sun hid behind the black cloud as I reached the bottom of the path and passed by the village of Sho. Pilgrims were everywhere, pilgrims from all parts of Tibet, and from beyond, come to pay their respects at the Potala. Horoscope vendors were there crying their wares, and those who had magic potions and charms were doing a brisk trade. The recent ceremonials had brought merchants, traders, hawkers and beggars of all description to the sacred road. Nearby a yak train was coming in through the western gate, laden with goods for the markets of Lhasa. I stopped to watch, thinking that I might never again see this so familiar sight, and feeling sick at heart at the thought of leaving. There was a rustle behind me. "Your blessing, Honorable Medical Lama," said a voice, and I turned to see one of the body breakers, one of the men who had done so much to help me when, by order of the L3TH Dalai Lama, he whose body I had just seen, I had studied with. When I had been able to get past the age-old tradition that bodies might not be dissected, I, because of my special task, had been given every facility to dissect bodies, and here was one of those men who had done so much to help me. I gave him my blessing, glad indeed that someone from the past recognized me. "Your teaching was wonderful," I said. "You taught me more than the medical school of Chongqing." He looked pleased, and put out his tongue to me in the manner of the serf. He backed away from me in the traditional manner, and mingled with the throng at the gate. For a few moments more I stood beside my horse, looking at the Potala, at the Iron Mountain, and then I went on my way, crossing the Gai River, and passing many pleasant parks. The ground here was flat and green with the green of well-watered grass, a paradise 12,800 feet above sea level, ringed by mountains rising yet another 6,000 feet, liberally speckled with lamaseries both large and small, and with isolated hermitages perched precariously on inaccessible rock spurs. Gradually the slope of the road increased, climbing to meet the mountain passes. My horse was fresh, well cared for and well fed. He wanted to hurry, I wanted to linger. Monks and merchants rode by, some of them looking at me curiously because I had departed from tradition and I was riding alone for greater speed. My father would never have ridden without an immense retinue as befitted his station. But I was of the modern age. So strangers looked at me curiously, but others whom I had known called a friendly greeting. At last my horse and I breasted the rise, and we came level with the great curtain of stones which was the last place from which Lhasa could be seen. I dismounted and tethered my horse, then sat on a convenient rock as I looked long into the valley. The sky was a deep blue, the deep blue that is only seen at such altitudes. Snow-white clouds drifted lazily overhead. A raven flopped down beside me and pecked inquiringly at my robe. As an afterthought I added a stone as custom demanded to the huge pile beside me, the pile which had been built up by the work of centuries of pilgrims, for this was the spot from whence pilgrims obtained their first and last view of the holy city. Before me was the Potala, with its walls sloping inwards from the base. The windows, too, sloped from the bottom to the top, adding to the effect. It looked like a building carved by gods from the living rock. My chakpura stood even higher than the Potala, without dominating it. Further I saw the golden roofs of the Jokhang, the 1300-year-old temple, surrounded by the administrative buildings. I saw the main road straight through, the willow grove, the swamps, the snake temple, and the beautiful patch which was the Nobulinga, and the Lama's gardens along by the Kaiachu. But the golden roofs of the Potala were ablaze with light, catching the brilliant sunlight, and throwing it back with gold-red rays, with every color of the spectrum. Here, beneath these cupolas rested the remains of the bodies of the Dalai Lama. The monument containing the remains of the L3TH was the highest of the lot, some 70 feet, 3 stories high, and covered with a ton of purest gold. And inside that shrine were precious ornaments, jewels, gold and silver. A fortune rested there beside the empty shell of its previous owner. And now Tibet was without a Dalai Lama, the last one had left, and the one yet to come, according to prophecy, would be one who would serve alien masters, one who would be in thrall of the communists. To the sides of the valley clung the immense lamaseries of Drepung, Sura, and Ganden. Half hidden in a clump of trees gleamed the white and gold of Nishung, the oracle of Lhasa, the oracle of Tibet. Drepung indeed looked like a rice heap, a white pile sprawled down the mountainside. Sura, known as the wild rose fence, and Ganden the joyous, I looked upon them and thought of the times I had spent within their walls, within their world townships. I looked, too, at the vast number of smaller lamaseries, perched everywhere, up the mountainsides, in groves of trees, and I looked too at the hermitages dotted in places most difficult of access, and my thoughts went out to the men within, immured, perhaps, for life in darkness with no light at all, with food but once a day, in darkness, never to come out again in the physical, but by their special training able to move and the astral, able to see the sights of the world as a disembodied spirit. My gaze wandered, the happy river meandered along through cuts and marshlands, hiding behind the skirts of trees, and reappearing in the open stretches. I looked and I saw the house of my parents, the large estate which had never been home to me. I saw pilgrims thronging the roads, making their circuits. Then from some distant lamasery I heard on the mild breeze the sound of the temple gongs, and the scream of the trumpets, and felt a lump rising in my throat and a stinging sensation in the bridge of my nose. It was too much for me. I turned and remounted my horse, and rode on, into the unknown. I went on with the country becoming wilder, and wilder. I passed from pleasant parklands and sandy soil, and small homesteads, to rocky eminences, and wild gorges through which water rushed continuously filling the air with sound, drenching me to the skin with the spray. I rode on, staying the nights as before at lamasery's. This time I was a doubly welcome guest, for I was able to give first-hand information about the recent sad ceremonials at Lhasa, for I was one of the men there, one of the officials. We all agreed that it was the end of an era, a sad time would come upon our land. I was provided with ample food and fresh horses, and after days of travel I again arrived at Yan, where, to my joy, the big car was waiting with Chsi, the driver. Reports had filtered through that I was on my way, and the old abbot at Chongqing had thoughtfully sent it for me. I was glad indeed, because I was saddle sore, and travel stained, and weary. It was a pleasure indeed to see that gleaming great vehicle, the product of another science, a product which would bear me along swiftly, doing in hours what I would normally take days to accomplish. So I got in the car, thankful that the abbot of the lamasery in Chongqing was my friend and had so much thought for my comfort and the my pleasure after the long arduous journey from my home in Lhasa. Soon we were speeding along the road to Chengdu. There we stayed the night. There was no point in hurrying and getting back to Chongqing in the small hours, so we stayed the night, and in the morning we looked around the place and did some local shopping. Then off we went again along the road to Chongqing. The red-faced boy was still at his plow, clad only in blue shorts. The plow drawn by the ungainly water buffalo. They wallowed through the mud trying to turn it over so that rice could be planted. We sped on faster, the birds overhead calling to one another, and making sudden swoops and darts as if for the sheer joy of living. Soon we were approaching the outskirts of Chongqing. We were approaching along the road lined with the silver eucalyptus trees, with the limes, and the green pine trees. Soon we came to a little road at which I alighted and made my way on foot up the path to the lamasery. As I once again passed that clearing with the fallen tree and the trees lying at crazy angles, I thought how memorable the events since I sat upon the bowl and talked with my guide, the Lama Minya, dawned up. I stopped a while in meditation, then I picked up my parcels once again and made my way on into the lamasery. In the morning, I went to Chongqing and the heat was like a living thing, sweltering, stifling. Even the rickshaw pullers and the passengers who rode with them were looking wilted and jaded, in the intolerable heat. I, from the fresh air in Tibet, felt more than half dead, but I as a lama had to keep erect as an example to others. In the Street of the Seven Stars I came across friend Huang busy shopping, and I greeted him as the friend he was. "Huang," I said, "what are all these people doing here?" "Why, Lobsang," he answered, "people are coming from Shanghai. The trouble there with the Japanese is causing traders to shut up their shops and to come here to Chongqing. I understand that some of the universities are seriously thinking of it as well, and by the way," he went on, "I have a message for you. General, now Marshal, Feng Uziang wants to see you. He asked me to give you the message. Go and see him as soon as you return." "All right," I said, "how about you coming up with me?" He said that he would. We did our leisurely shopping. It was far too hot to hurry, and then we went back to the Lamasery. An hour or two later we made our way up to the temple near where the general had his home, and there I saw him. He told me much about the Japanese and the trouble they were making in Shanghai. He told me how the international settlement there had recruited a police force of thugs and crooks who were not really trying to restore order. He said, "War is coming, Rampa, war is coming. We need all the doctors we can, and doctors who are also pilots. We must have them." He offered me a commission in the Chinese army, and gave me to understand that I could fly as much as I should like. The general was an immense man, well over 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders and a huge head. He had been in many campaigns, and now he had thought, until the Japanese difficulty, that his days as a soldier were over. He was a poet, too, and he lived near the temple for viewing the moon. I liked him. He was a man with whom I could get on, a clever man. Apparently, so he told me, one incident in particular had been sponsored by the Japanese to give them a pretext for invading China. Some Japanese monk had been killed by accident, and the Japanese authorities demanded that the Mev Shanghai should prohibit the boycott of Japanese goods, disband the Association for National Deliverance, arrest the leaders of the boycott, and guarantee compensation for the killing of that monk. The mayor, to preserve the peace and thinking of the overwhelming force of the Japanese, accepted the ultimatum on the 28th of January, 1932. But at 10:30 that night, after the mayor had actually accepted the ultimatum, the Japanese marines began occupying a number of streets in the international settlement, and so paving the way for the next world war. This was all news to me. I knew nothing at all about it because I had been traveling elsewhere. As we were talking, a monk came, dressed in a grey-black gown, to tell us that the Supreme Abbot Taishu was here, and we had to see him as well. I had to tell him about events in Tibet, about the last ceremonies of my beloved L3TH Dalai Lama. He in turn told me of the grave fears which he and others had for the safety of China. "Not that we fear the final outcome," he said, "but the destruction, the death, and the suffering which will come first." So they pressed me again to accept a commission in the Chinese forces, to place my training at their disposal. And then came the blow. "You must go to Shanghai," said the general. "Your services are very much needed there, and I suggest that your friend, Boku, goes with you. I have made preparations already, it is but for you, and he, to accept." "Shanghai," I said. "That's a terrible place to be in. I really do not think much of it. However, I know that I must go, and so I will accept." We talked on and on, and the evening shadows gradually crept in upon us, and the day turned to dusk, so that eventually we had to part. I rose to my feet, and made my way out into the courtyard, where the solitary palm was looking faded, and wilted in the heat, with its leaves hanging down, and turning brown. Huang was sitting patiently waiting for me, sitting immobile, wondering why the interview was so long. He, too, rose to his feet. Silently we made our way down the path, past the rushing gorge, and over the little stone bridge, down toward our own Lamasery. There was a large rock before the entrance to our path and we climbed upon it, where we could look out over the rivers. There was much activity nowadays. Little steamers were chugging along. Flames of smoke rising from their funnels being caught by the wind, were being blown off into a black banner. Yes, there were more steamers now than ever before I left for Tibet. Refugees were coming in more every day, more traffic. People who could see into the future, and see what the invasion of China would really mean. There was more congestion in a city already congested. As we looked up into the night sky we could see the great storm clouds piling up, and we knew that later in the night there would be a thunderstorm rolling down from the mountains, swamping the place with torrential rain and deafening us with the echo and rumbles. Was this, we thought, a symbol of the troubles to come upon China? It certainly seemed so. The air was dense, electric. I think we both sighed in unison to think of the future of this land of which we were both so fond. But the night was upon us. The first heavy drops of the rainstorm were coming down and wetting us. We turned together, and made our way into the temple to where the abbot was waiting for us, Agog to be told all that had happened. I was glad indeed to see him, and to discuss matters, and to receive his praise for the course which I had agreed to undertake. Far into the night we talked, and talked, deafened at times by the roaring thunder, and by the rushing of the rain upon the temple roof. Eventually we made our way to our beds upon the floor, and went to sleep. With the coming of the morning, after the first service, we made our preparations to set off again on the start of yet another phase of life, an even more unpleasant stage. E course which I had agreed to Chapter 6 Clairvoyance, Shanghai. I had no illusions. I knew that Shanghai was going to be a very difficult spot indeed in which to live. But fate had decreed that I should go there, and so we made our preparations, Boku and I, and later in the morning we walked together down the street of steps, down to the docks, and went aboard a ship which would take us far down the river to Shanghai. In our cabin, we shared a cabin, I lay upon my bunk, and thought of the past. I thought of the first time that I had known anything about Shanghai. It was when my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, was teaching me the finer points of clairvoyance, and as this particular knowledge may be of interest and help to many, I will give the actual experience here. It was a few years previously, when I was a student in one of the great lamasseries of Lhasa. I and others of my class were sitting in the schoolroom longing to be out. The class was worse than usual, for the teacher was a great bore, one of our worst. The whole class was finding it difficult to follow his words and remain alert. It was one of those days when the sun was shining warmly, when light fleecy clouds raced high overhead. Everything called us to go outside into the warmth and sunshine, away from musty classrooms and the droning voice of an uninteresting teacher. Suddenly there was commotion. Someone had come into the room. We, with our backs to the teacher, could not see who it was, and we dared not turn and look in case he was looking at us. The rustle of paper, HMM ruining my class. A sharp crack as the teacher brought his cane down on his desk, making all of us jump high with fright. Lobsang Rampa, come here. Filled with foreboding, I rose to my feet, turned and made my three bows. What had I done now? Had the abbot seen me dropping pebbles on those visiting lamas? Had I been observed sampling those pickled walnuts? Had I? But the voice of the teacher soon put my mind at rest. Lobsang Rampa, the honorable senior lama, your guide, Minya Dondup, requires you at once. Go, and pay more attention to him than you have to me. I went, in a hurry. Along the corridors, up the stairs, round to the right, and into the precincts of the lamas. Tread softly here, I thought, some crusty old dodderers along here. Seventh door left, that is it. Just as I raised my hand to knock, a voice said come in, and in I went. Your clairvoyance never fails when there is food about. I have tea and pickled walnuts. You are just in time. The Lama Minya Dondup had not expected me so early, but now he certainly made me welcome. As we ate he talked. I want you to study crystal gazing, using the various types of appliances. You must be familiar with them all. After our tea he led me down to the storeroom. Here were kept the appliances of all kinds, planchettes, tarot cards, black mirrors, and a perfectly amazing range of devices. We wandered around, he pointing out various objects and explaining their use. Then, turning to me, he said, pick a crystal which you feel will be harmonious to you. Look at them all, and make your choice. I had my eyes on a very beautiful sphere, genuine rock crystal without a flaw and of such a size that it needed two hands to hold it. I picked it up and said, this is the one I want. My guide laughed. You have chosen the oldest and most valuable. If you can use it, you can have it. This particular crystal, which I still have, had been found in one of the tunnels far below the Potala. In those unenlightened days it had been called the magic ball and given to the medical lamas of the Iron Mountain as it was considered to be connected with medicine. A little later in this chapter one will deal with glass spheres, black mirrors, and water globes, but now it may be of interest to describe how we prepared to use the crystal, how we trained ourselves to become as one with it. It is obvious that if one is healthy, physically and mentally fit, the sight is at its best. So it is with the third eyesight. One must be fit, and to that end we prepared before trying to use any of these devices. I had picked up my crystal, and now I looked at it.